This episode of The Next Step is brought to you by New South and Anna Jacobson's book, How to Knit a Human. How to Knit a Human is about Anna's quest to find herself and her memory after going through psychosis and electroconvulsive therapy in 2021 at the age of 23. Jacobson says that the impetus for writing the book was the splintering of her memory and self after this experience. She writes, "The madness itself is a void that has no memory, and I have to knit and braid myself around it." The book is about the struggle to reclaim yourself when the memory of the very thing that is so pivotal and life-changing just isn't there. I, Catherine, think a lot about art and its role in a complex and often turbulent world. When there's so much bad stuff that happens, what is the point of it? Art and the making of art is central to this book. How to Knit a Human shows exactly what the point is. It's not just about expression, it's an act of hope and ultimately of survival. Welcome to The Next Step. The next step is figuratively, but also literally in this case, what happens after the first time. It's about figuring out what to do next in life, specifically how to manage the push-pull between ambition and contentment. Like, what do you have to do to achieve the things you want, and how can you be happy if you achieve nothing? Sometimes I wonder, would I be better off spending my time setting goals and making lists or meditating? Perhaps I should do a vision board. How do people make money and grow successful multi-million dollar businesses? Like, what are the actual steps? And are ice baths the answer to everything? I'm Catherine Collette, and this is The Next Step. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This interview is with Brianna Garza. Brianna Garza is a professional basketball shooting coach, instructional designer, and the founder and owner of Shooters Shoot, a mentorship program that focuses both on shot development and thought development. The training model was inspired by Brianna's passion for coaching both the science and the mindset of shooting. Brianna is a former National Collegiate Athletic Association player and current shooting coach for the actual American NBA, WNBA, the NCAA, and youth players. I came to Brianna via Instagram. I will link so you can follow her there. Her handle is at shootersxshoot70. True to her philosophy, her Instagram is half about basketball and half about thought development. Definitely worth a follow. Many listeners to the show will have heard me talk about Ben Crowe before. Brianna reminds me of Ben Crowe, except she's young, not that he's old, and she's a woman. She very much has the same vein of thinking in that her work is about inspiring people to do and be their best and live with purpose. She's super positive and smart and fun. I am such a big fan of hers, and I reckon you will be too after listening. Welcome, Brianna.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm so excited to be here.
I want to start very simply by talking about basketball. Tell us where your earliest basketball career began. How did you start playing the game?
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Remember the Titans?
No.
No, it's a classic. It's with Denzel Washington. And the reason I asked that is because there's a little girl in that movie that, you know, grew up on the football field and was yelling at the linebackers and was just a total tomboy. So to answer your question, I mean, my daddy was a football coach in Austin, Texas. And in Texas, I don't know if you know about football, but it's like a religion in Texas. Friday night lights and playoff football. There are stadiums that are in Texas that are bigger than like college stadiums in other states that are high school stadiums. And so, my dad always had keys to the gym, and basketball was my first love. It was something I was always really good at. I was never the biggest, fastest, strongest or anything like that, but I was always very skilled because I loved being in the gym. It challenged me. So that's how I got my start with basketball, was just having access, really.
I love that you say you were never the biggest, fastest, or strongest on the team. I've heard you say this elsewhere and follow it up by saying you learned at a very young age to focus your time on developing your vision, your IQ, and most importantly, your shot. Can you tell me about each of those things in turn?
Yeah. So being that I had like my dad as my coach really early. He taught me how to read the game, kind of like a quarterback. So a quarterback in football, you have checkdowns, right? Depending on what route or what offense, if you're running an option or if you're running, you know, wildcat or whatever it is that you're doing, you have different checkdowns that you do as a quarterback. So they look to this receiver, that receiver, that receiver, and then pick which one they're going to throw to. Same thing in basketball. There's kind of rules that govern the game. So progressions at which you should look to see if somebody's open, depending on what the defense sets up in. So for example, a really common defense in basketball is a 2-3 zone. So you have two people up top, three people at the bottom. To respond to a 2-3 zone on offense, you want to have like an organization that's going to be the opposite. So if there's two people up front, you just want one person up front for you, and then three people, and then one person. That's one way you could do it. If you have a defense that's playing a 1-3-1 defense, then you set up in a 2-1-2. So things like that, the chess part of basketball, those are the vision and the IQ. Those are where some of that came from, is my dad was able to teach me when I was very young. And then I played a lot with my big brother, and he was 9 years older than me and didn't go easy on me. And so I got to develop, and I was just always kind of fiery, and I wanted to compete all of the time. And that's how I developed that. And shooting, yeah, I didn't start studying shooting like I do now until, maybe in the last 5 years or so. Shooting was just a necessity for me as a player, as a small player, especially. And for the same reason that I think some people are born with the ability to sing or dance or draw or write novels, I was just very naturally born with a little bit of confidence, like very naturally. And so shooting came easy, because that's what a lot of shooting is just letting yourself be confident, whether you missed a bunch of shots or not. So that's where I think the shot development came in, is partly due to my confidence, and part of it was just staying in the gym. I love to be in the gym.
So where were you, and what did life look like when you started to think about becoming a shooting coach? And is a shooting coach a thing that exists?
Yeah. There aren't too many of us, but they're multiplying on social media every day. Yeah, there's a ton of shooting coaches in my comments section all the time. You know what I mean? It started in 2021, end of 2020, throughout 2021, I was working at a gym in Phoenix, and in order to get players in the gym, we would do these free 30-minute shooting workouts to try and get their foot in the door and see if we could make them up into our client. And I used to do like 14, 15 of those every week, just a hustler. And I had to get really, really good at making somebody feel like they were a better shooter in 30 minutes. And so I got a ton of reps at doing that. And then I started to study it, and just became fascinated with it, with the, you know, my background is in sport and performance psychology and instructional design, and the way that those things were able to tie into shooting and studying the mechanics and the physics of shooting is kind of my new chapter. So I studied mechanics first, and then I studied biomechanics of body. And then just recently now, my chapter of study and learning is in the physics of basketball. So 2021, that year was the most tumultuous year of my life. Three really, life altering things happened that year. In February, my fiance at the time, just out of left field, left. And, a few months later, I lost my dog in June, Finnegan. And then in October of that same year, our CEO, that was the owner of the company in Phoenix, flew down, and he did it all in the right way. There's no bad blood or anything like that. But at 6 a.m., he called us all into a meeting, and he told us that they were going to be closing the doors in December. So we had plenty of time to plan and all of that. But know, I've lost my fiance, my dog, and my job all within 8 or 9 months. And so that that morning I left that meeting, and I had a 14-hour day of training that day. This is the trenches, you know? And I remember just that whole day having the most fun with all of my athletes, just because I knew these were going to be some of my last moments with them. And I got home that night at about 10 o'clock, 10:30, and I just had a good cry out on the front porch. And then I took a deep breath. It was like 11 o'clock at night and 111 degrees outside in Phoenix, Arizona. And the idea hit me like a Mack truck, shoot or shoot. So I grabbed my laptop and I got on Canva and made the first, actually the one I'm wearing right now, the first like flagship design, figured out what my logo looked like. And my roommate at the time, her name was Macy. She was a college basketball player. She just got home from study hall, and I showed her, and I was just like, yo, look at this thing I created. I've been sitting on this idea for so long, and this is what I got. She was like, oh my gosh, that's sick. I'm going to get one, like order me one. Oh. And she goes to bed, not, you know, I stay outside working. So in the morning, she actually had to get up at about, 5:15, 5:30, because they had morning practice. And when she walked out, I was still outside on the front porch, just building, and I haven't stopped since then.
Incredible. It's funny, shoot is shoot. In the writing world, we often say writers write. Like, that's what you...
Writers write. That's right.
So interesting. I wanted to just ask, on the 30-minute sessions, which I can completely see how doing so many of those really hones that skill, when you're wanting someone to walk away with something after just 30 minutes, are you focusing on a skill or a mindset? If a lot of shooting comes from confidence, what are you trying to achieve in that 30 minutes?
Yeah. So it first starts with being able to quickly recognize needs based on the athlete, where they are, what their shot looks like. So some athletes are really good shooters, and maybe there's just like one small thing that needs to be adjusted. And so it's up to you as the coach to identify that and then know how to speak to that. Some athletes come up and their shots just completely broke. Like, they don't know what they're doing at all. So you gotta help them feel the physics of shooting, what shooting should feel like. And so ultimately what I would do is kind of a pre-test post-test thing. I'd put them on a shooting machine where it rebounds for them. And I have them take 25, 50 shots without any coaching at all. We measure them. I spend then 20 minutes working with them, moving the pieces, letting them experiment with it, all these different things. And then at the end, if I do my job, then, you know, obviously it's a small sample size, but then you take your post-test and you do better than you did on the pre-test. So
a great way to demonstrate too, that someone has improved.
Yeah. And then there were times like towards the end where I got a little cocky and about it, and like, I could just call my shot. Like, so I could remember my kid Kyle, he was my first level 5 shooter, which I just had different levels marked out depending on what kind of shots they were taking at what percentage. And Kyle, the first time he came to me, I watched him shoot, and I said, I'm going to speed your shot up by like nearly a second by the time you leave here. And then you're not even going to feel like it's faster. He was like, okay. And so I was like, watch. So he took his pre-test or whatever. He was already a really good shooter, so I didn't really have to change anything. We just redirected the physics a little bit to make it faster without him having to really do much different. And so I filmed him from the side at the beginning, and then we worked through it. I gave him the cues that he needed to shoot faster. He sped up his shot, you know, twice as fast. And then I took a second video, and then before they left, I put him side by side and just got to show him how much faster his shot was without really feeling like he changed much at all. And so it was just things like that. You stare at something long enough, you start to see the nuances.
Mm. And so the goals of Shoot is Shoot are currently shot development and thought development. Were those two things equally weighted from the very beginning?
Yes, I would say so. I would say that as coaches, it's really easy to forget why we coach, and forget that it really has nothing to do with basketball at all. especially at the youth level, at the development level. We're not teaching or expecting every single one of our athletes to go pro and make a living out of this. But what we are teaching them is how to go through hard things, how to go through shooting slumps, and how to keep it moving. How to mastery is T-shaped, right? If you can figure out how to be a master of shooting, you can figure out mastery in anything that you want to do. And so it's a really safe medium to teach how to make mistakes and how to just not judge your mistakes, just to study them and correct them with urgency instead. So there's just more to be taught through teaching shooting than just basketball. And so shot development and thought development, we teach confidence through the medium of shooting.
I love that. And what is linked with that, a culture of error, and why is it so important?
Yeah, because we all mess up. Like, it's so funny how much we fear making mistakes, and shooting, like, you're going to make a ton of them. And so teaching mistakes as something not to be feared, or failure as something not to be feared, rather we just stare that fear in the face and we have a conversation with it instead. We study it rather than letting it dictate what we do. And so if you can teach somebody that, they only have to really feel it work one time to really buy into it. And so that's like the whole pinnacle of it, is teaching people how to overcome and how to respond to their mistakes rather than taking mistakes as failures or as anything other than little victories that are nudging you toward who you're becoming.
I'm interested too in, we talk about managing mistakes. Is there an element as well, and this is a genuine question, I don't know the answer, of managing victories? Like, is a goal ever to be able to shrug off the loss, the shots that didn't go in and the shots that did go in? Or should you celebrate the shots that did go in? Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, good question. So I think there's a place for both. I think there's lots of schools of thought. Like neutral thinking is a school of thought that's very helpful inside of your games, right? Inside of your actual matches, competitions, having neutral thoughts while, like, whether the shot goes in or shot does not go in, you just say something like, oh, how about that? Very, you know, neutral, so you stay here. Whereas I think it's important to, I think we teach athletes a lot to, like, hinder their emotions and to push them down. Like, you have to be mentally tough, yada, yada. In my workouts, especially in my one-on-one workouts, and especially with my more advanced players, I encourage them to get mad, like to punt the basketball or something. And then, go get the basketball that you just punted and bring it back, and we're going to keep it moving. I think we teach athletes to push emotions away for so long that when they get into a game, and this is the highest physiological, you know, they've heightened, you know, attention and all of these things, fight or flight. And if we've repressed those emotions always, then of course they're going to erupt in a way that's not advantageous when they're in games. And so if we let them work through these emotions during practice and push them, then when they get into games, we teach them, okay, you've done all of this work. You've trained yourself, you've studied yourself, you've gotten mad at the misses, you've celebrated the makes. And now when you get into a game, you get to let this other version of yourself, self two, right? So self one is the judging mind. This is the one you study. Self two is just the body that does. And if you can just let the body do what it's supposed to do without judging it or casting judgments or getting too high or too low, that's where I think flow and mastery lives. That comes going into my senior year of college, and it completely everything about the way I thought about my performance.
Interesting. Linked with that sort of neutrality of emotion, but coming at it from a different tact, if you're a coach, what is the role of something like praise?
Like praise?
How do you shape a player? Is praise one part of that? The only part?
Yeah. Behaviors that get celebrated get repeated. Praise is a non-negotiable for coaches. Like if you know, there's this old, you know, kind of this old school version of coaching that's very negative, punishment, all of that. And research has shown that doesn't work. Like, it doesn't shape players to be the very best version of themselves. There's a breadth of research that has shown positive reinforcement and praise to shape behavior in a much more powerful way. Successive approximations of behavior, for example. This is, I think, one of the questions you had listed in preparations for this was, when you praise pieces of behavior that are inching them closer to the outcome you're expecting, then they're naturally going to repeat those behaviors and get closer and closer to the things, to the goal intended outcome. So that it ties back into, you know, operant conditioning in psychology is, yeah, behaviors that get celebrated get repeated. If you want somebody to continue to shoot the basketball, even if they're missing, then you praise the take and not the make. That's a huge part of the way that I coach. I can't help it. I just get hyped. It's just, you're supposed to have fun as a coach. You're supposed to instill self-belief into players. And the only way that can be done is through praise.
I like that. I want to circle back to shooting. I'm also coaching a basketball team at the moment, but the team that I'm coaching is my son's team and it's under 10s. So if you have a group of players, be it young players or more experienced players, whatever that looks like, what does a program of shot development look like? What are the kind of overarching elements?
Yeah, it depends on age and stage. It depends on a lot of things, really. But if we're talking age and stage, like your job coaching your son's under 10 team is to make sure they associate basketball with love and with fun, right? And psychological safety. So making sure that their teammates aren't ridiculing them when they make mistakes, that they're not, you know, that they feel safe in an environment where they feel like the people around them are standing shoulder to shoulder with them and are trying really hard as well. And, you know, as far as basics go, we teach, you know, physics, right? We teach one motion. So if we're teaching you to shoot like an athlete in a way that complements your body, then you're going to catch the ball, load your body, and then shoot smoothly up. What a lot of young players tend to do is they tend to chest the ball here and try to shoot from their chest. So because for whatever reason, that feels a little bit more natural, especially for our young girls. But teaching them foundationally to allow themselves to load the ball a little lower by their stomach and lift the ball up, that would be foundational how I would develop a young player. Shot development for an older player or a pro is a lot of the time more unlearning than it is learning.
That's an interesting point. What about the role of visualization? What role do you think it plays in either shooting or basketball more broadly?
Yeah. There's a lot of research, a lot of evidence for visualization, and there's a ton of different ways you could do it. The type of visualization that I like to use is really in the form of emotional reps, emotional visualization. So picturing it. So you played sports, yes?
Mm-hmm. I did. I played basketball.
You played basketball. Can you remember somebody you played against that every time she guarded you, you like low-key, you hated it? Like, you're
yes,
like,
oh, I definitely can. Again.
Can you see her like in yes. in your head? Like, yes. Clear? Yeah. Okay. So for me, it was a girl named Navia Palou was her name. She played on my rival team in college and she was studying my film. She was studying my go-to moves. She always made it so difficult on me to score. And I wanted to score on her so bad. And so for me, what I did is every single time I was in the gym alone, I actually wasn't. Navia Palou was standing right in front of me, guarding me, cutting me off. Now I'm losing the ball on my dribble. Now when I make shots, it means a little bit more to me. When I miss shots, I get a bit more frustrated. And so this is the closest we can get to the same physiological reactions and care that you're going to be experiencing in a game. And that's a huge piece of, I mean, you can't really get there until you've achieved a certain level of mastery of shooting itself. And then you can start challenging your mind. But if you make it personal, then you can prepare your body and mind for those high stress moments where, you know, crowds in the stands and all that. And if you don't ever practice with emotional reps, with visualization of somebody in front of you, of what's happening, of how much each of these shots means to you, then when you go into a game and you don't perform, then it's funny that you would expect yourself to perform because you've never actually put yourself in that position before. You've only ever put your body in that position before. You've never actually put your mind there. And so that level of training is usually reserved for somebody who's already at a level of mastery, because otherwise I need to recruit your mind in studying, you know, your body or externally focusing on your target or on your spin or on, you know, avoiding crushing the egg or, you know, things like that. But that's like the type of visualization that I do personally in the work that I do.
Interesting. I was thinking about the role of visualization and how that basketball example could be adapted to other situations. And I think maybe part of it, like related to that sort of emotional element, it's about making sure to visualize with pressure applied. So in a non-sporting situation, say if you're a writer doing events and there's sort of a public speaking element, there's no opposition, but the audience applies pressure. So that's sort of a way of adapting that approach for non-competitive scenarios. I wondered if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, because what the same part of your brain that feels excitement is the part of your brain that feels fear, right? So the thing is just the perspective change and the comfort and the exposing yourself to those stressful, sometimes overwhelmed type of emotions. And in my experience, those emotional type reps are the closest we can get to preparing ourselves for whatever physiological, psychological element that's going to come up. So in writing or public speaking, figuring that your heckler, like the one that's going to be like the hardest on you or give you the, you know, the meatiest feedback is there sitting there watching you. Like, how are you going to perform in front of them? And seeing that when you're practicing, when you're rehearsing, all, you know, and of course, nothing is going to replace the reps. But if you're taking those types of reps where, you know, the person at your same age and skill level is just taking regular reps where there's not really that emotional element to it, like you are going to perform better than somebody who's just getting, I don't want to say empty reps, but for, you know, for sake of argument, empty reps.
That's good advice. Brianna, one of your Instagram videos is about the Pygmalion effect. How has the Pygmalion effect, it's probably been mispronounced, but how has it impacted your work?
That's great.
Oh, good, good. Excellent.
Yeah. how has it influenced my work?
Yeah.
In so many ways. I remember exactly where I was when I first learned about it from a psychology teacher my freshman year of college. You know, the study was, you know, these psychologists in the 80s, I mean, in the 80s, psychologists could do like whatever they wanted to do. Like, you know, we didn't really know the repercussions of anything, of kind of messing with people's minds. You couldn't do this probably today, but they, you know, just for the audience listening, these psychologists, they went to an elementary school principal and they said, hey, we have this idea. We think we can improve the livelihood and the mental capacity of some of your students. Would you be into that? And the principal said, whatever, sure, do it. And they gave this test to every athlete, every child in the elementary school, every student. Then they gathered up all of the tests and they threw them away. And then they told all of the teachers, hey, these seven students, arbitrary, totally random, these seven students in your class are bloomers. We're expecting them based on these test scores to do better than all of their peers. Not true at all, but the teachers believed it to be true. So at the end of the year, all of those students, or a significant amount of those students, an overwhelming majority, did better than the students who were not labeled as bloomers. Not because they were actually smarter or better or anything like that, but the teachers simply believed it to be so. So what do we take from that is believing in people literally shapes them into becoming better, more able, smarter, maybe even more confident people, simply because the teachers gave them more chances when they made mistakes. They didn't feel ridiculed when they got things wrong. They overall just had this underlying belief that these students were going to do better. And so they did. Imagine that. Your teachers think you're going to do better, so you do. And so this was such a simple, simple thing that made sense to me. Mm-hmm. And ever since, like, I can remember exactly where I was. I don't remember the name of the professor, but I can see her in my head right now. She had long hair and she would wear these crazy dresses. And I carried that with me in the way that I even worked with my teammates, in the way I led my team, in the way that I lead my athletes now, my staff now that I'm a business owner. And yeah, it's shaped a large amount of my philosophy as a coach.
Mm, it's so profound. And they would also never repeat it. Like,
yeah, 1,000%.
Now, we've talked a lot about coaching and the shooting work that you do. When you think about your own career, how do you think about what you want or what you want to achieve? Do you use things like visualization or manifestation or goals? Or do you just kind of shift from one thing to the next a little bit more intuitively?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is I'm very intentional. Much of what I do is very purpose driven, and so a lot of people ask me, you know, what's your goal with Shoot or Shoot? Like, what's your end game? And you know, to be honest with you, it's, you know, I about a year ago, I went to New Orleans to see the New Orleans Pelicans and the Mavericks play. A good friend of mine was coaching for the Mavericks, and I went, and they were staying at the Four Seasons Hotel in New Orleans. So I said, okay, I'm going to be there. Like, I'm going to crash with you. And when I got there, my friend wasn't feeling well. And so I just went down to the hotel bar, and I, you know, I'm just having a lobster roll and a whiskey. And I'm sitting there, and I look across from me, and there were these three people. They were talking to a bald man, and I did a double take, and the man was Hank from Breaking Bad. Have you ever seen Breaking Bad?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it was Hank. It was
amazing. Right
from me. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. And so I didn't go over there or anything. Like, I played it cool, and he ended up getting up and leaving, walking upstairs, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And so then right after that, these two people come up walking next to me, and they are decked out in Pelicans gear, like head to toe, sweatpants, everything. And so I assumed that they were going to the game the next day. So I struck up with a conversation with them, and it turns out that they were. And they said their son had just gotten traded to the Pelicans. Their son was an NBA player. I was like, oh my gosh, you must be so proud. And they said, yeah, CJ's always been a really good kid. And this is CJ McCollum, who is like top 20, top 25 in the NBA. Like, I mean, an NBA star. And so I'm like, CJ McCollum's parents. Like, oh my God. And so we got to chit chat and just hanging out. And then they eventually, you know, took a moment. They stepped outside. And then all of a sudden, this man comes and sits next to me on the other side. And he leans in and he says, hey, I need you to save me. And I'm like,
what is this night?
I know, that's what I'm saying. And it was Hank.
Oh,
from Breaking Bad. And he leaves, and I was like, save you. I was like, what do you mean? You were like, these people, they won't leave me alone. And I was like, oh my God, you looked like you were enjoying yourself over there. And he was like, yeah, well, and I was like, must be what it's like to be an Emmy award-winning actor. And he was like, what gave it away? And I was like,
your face.
Yeah, no, he was like, oh, it was the face. It was the face. And I said, yeah, it was the face. And so now I'm sitting here next to Hank. Dean Norris is his name. Hank from Breaking Bad. And we're just chopping it up. We're having a couple whiskeys. And I text my friend who had a stomach ache. And I was like, girl, forget your stomach ache. Like, you need to come down here. Like, Hank from Breaking Bad. She's like, Hank? I was like, yeah, come on. So she comes down. And my friend, who was a coach at the time for the Mavericks, is a WNBA all-star. I mean, legend. Crazy career path. And so she comes down, and now I'm in this bar at the Four Seasons in New Orleans, and I've got a WNBA all-star on this side, and I've got an Emmy award-winning actor on this side, the highest performers at their craft in the world. And so I'm obviously not saying anything. I'm just sitting back and like listening and soaking it all in. And they, you know, were chopping it up, and they really, really related to one another on the blessings and the curse that it is to be the highest performer ever, right? And so then they were talking, they really bonded, and they were talking about the moment, you know, the winning the WNBA championship or getting the Emmy for your performance, and you're standing with all these people around you that love you, care about you, and the confetti is falling, and you're like holding the trophy in your hands, and the first thing that they both felt was sadness.
Mm.
Like, what's next? And I remember like hearing that and really sitting with it. And what I learned from that and what I learned from them in that moment is that I don't really have a goal. Everything I do is very purpose-driven. And it's not that I don't set my sights on really high things, but I don't attach myself to those things. I use them as ways to let my purpose keep driving me. And the cool shit that happens on the way is just a byproduct of letting the path do its thing and setting my intentions where they need to be set. And, you know, I do this exercise in many of the camps that I run, where I have my athletes write down their like big audacious goal. And I have them write them down in the form of I am. And, you know, I don't ever ask any of my students to do anything that I'm not trying to do myself. And so I tell them my audacious statements. And, you know, mine is I'm a millionaire and I'm a WNBA and an NBA shooting coach. And I bought my mom her dream house back. I don't know if those things are really going to happen, but I know that that's what I'm working towards. And certainly some cool shit's going to happen along the way.
Mm, that is a great story on many fronts. It's interesting because we can have different goals like winning the Emmy Award. It sounds like your goals, I mean, you want to make $1 million. You know, that's a great goal. But I wonder if you are buffeted in some ways against that potential sadness or disappointment with achievement because so much of your work is about others.
I think all of our work is about others, not just mine. You know, Ubuntu is part of my mission statement. Ubuntu is it's a phrase that comes from Zulu origin in South Africa from the Zulu tribe. And what it translates to is I am because you are, and you are because I am. So the reason I work so hard, the reason I study and I, you know, stay up late and I watch film and all of that, it really has nothing to do with me. It has to do with you. So that I could be here on this podcast with you, you know, having the better things to say because it's going to make your business and your brand better. And the reason you write and you take the time is not for you. It's for the people that are going to read what you write. And so Ubuntu is a way of being. And I remember exactly where I was when I first heard that word and that concept, and it made a lot of things click for me because you're right. Like much of my life is in service to others. And so you can sometimes get lost in over-serving and like neglecting yourself. And Ubuntu strikes such that perfect balance of like, no, like I have to take care of my mental and myself and meet myself physically so that I can serve the people around me, because it's not really about me, it's about them. And so that does remove pressure, on your performance or whatever, because it's not really about you anyway. It's about taking the right shot, taking the risk, overcoming failure, right? Because it really has nothing to do with me. It's how I can show up for the people around me.
Good answer. Brianna, what habits or routines have been the most effective for you in relation to your work, but also to your life?
Are you a
glass of warm water with lemon in it kind of person?
The best, honestly, like I'm not a creature of habit. I'm really not. Like if there's any habit that I have that has really, I think, allowed me to like continue at the pace that I've been on this, I've been on this hustle and grind for nearly 3 years. Nearly 3 years now. And I think I do an excellent job of taking balance within my days. So if I want to stop what I'm doing and go take a walk for an hour and a half in the sunlight, like I'm going to put my headphones on and go do that. Or there were 2 days last week where right now I'm in this really heavy fundraising stage of my conference that I'm running here. And there were 2 days last week where it was the first couple of days where it was like 65 and sunny outside. So there were 2 days back to back where I spent at least an hour, hour and a half just laying out in the sunlight. Because like, that's what I like felt I needed to do. And so I listened to my balance very instinctively. And so today, for example, I was on the phone with my partner and she was like, and I was like, yeah, I can use this plane ride. I'm going to Minnesota tomorrow to run a basketball camp. And I was like, I can use the plane ride to get a bunch of work done. But I just really love to watch movies and sleep on planes. And she was like, ah, we'll just see how you feel. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm 13 days out from my conference. Like, this is one of those times where I'm going to have to be disciplined. It's not really about how I feel right now. It's about like needing to, you know, put myself and my feet where they need to be. And so because I think I do such a good job of taking my balance when I can afford it, I have the energy and the wherewithal to like, when I have to buckle down and do it when I don't feel like it, I have, my tank isn't empty.
It's the balance of balance, isn't it?
The balance of balance, exactly. Balance squared.
Brianna, we love talking about failures on this podcast. Do you have a favorite failure?
I think it's one time when I was early in my teaching career, and I had to teach a pretty complex concept. And when you're teaching complex concepts, if you don't understand it, certainly you're not going to be able to communicate it and teach it to somebody else. And I really hadn't done my due diligence in my preparation. I thought that I'd had, but I didn't. And so I remember getting done with that morning session. It was clear that all of the athletes were confused, but we were just trying to move them through it. And they were like, just not knowing where to go. And it was just painful. It was so painful. We dismissed them to lunch. And I remember going to the bathroom and just sobbing and crying. And because I just, you know, wanted to do a great job. And like, I knew that I didn't serve those athletes in the way that I should have. And it was so difficult. Like I can still, it was in Sacramento when it happened. And so then but then something really astute and something that I still carry with me today happened right after that. A mentor of mine, Brittany Caporale is her name. She looked at me and could tell I was upset, and she kind of let me come down from it a little bit. And then she looked at me and she goes, how much fun are you having right now? And I was like, okay, like, that's exactly what I needed somebody to say to me. And that's often been something I've used in my own leadership. When I run, you know, retreats and I'm working with high level athletes and they have 8 or 9 sessions where they just look terrible. It happens, right? You blow the whistle and they're afraid. Like, oh my gosh, we're going to get laid into. And instead, not every time, you know, sometimes it's time for you to put your foot down and say like, you're not meeting the standard right now. But sometimes when they're working very hard, right, when they're doing all of the right things, if the shots aren't going in or things aren't going the right way or whatever, then I'll blow the whistle. And what I'll say is, remind yourself how much fun you're having right now. And then you can kind of feel the energy in the room, like sit down, like, you guys are great basketball players. All right. You just messed up. Like, that was embarrassing. You know, if y'all just messed up like 8 or 9 times in a row. And that happens. Remind yourself how much fun you're having right now. And then it's like, you know, you feel the energy elevate, the next you see a shot or two go in, and now we're rolling again. So that from that failure, I found, thanks to a mentor, one of the most profound, like, little pieces of teaching that I still carry with me.
Yeah, a thing I often say to myself in situations where you're feeling nervous or overwhelmed is, how good is this? Like, fuck it. How good is it? Like that reframe of like similar kind of thing, you know,
like 100%.
It completely shifts the way that you're approaching a situation. Yeah. We are onto the quick fire questions. End of the interview. Some of these will be easy to answer and some of them you can pass on if they're too hard.
Okay.
The first one is, what is the best thing you've bought for under $100 in the last 6 months?
The best thing I bought for under $100 is the headphones that I have right now. I don't have them on me, but they're the coolest things I've ever used. They like kind of wrap around your ears, so they look a little funny, but like I can like,
yeah, perfect.
Like, yeah, move around and it's like just stay. And that's like my biggest problem when I'm working out. It's so annoying. You have to keep putting your headphones in. Such a small thing, but I realized when I started wearing those, like, gosh, this is just like so much more enjoyable. So yeah, those headphones that will wrap around.
Perfect. What does the first 60 minutes of your day look like? Although this is probably going to look different every day if you're not a creature of habit.
Yeah. I generally herkle-durkle just a little bit. You know what that term means? I just read it. I'm not even sure if it's real. I just read it on the internet somewhere. But apparently herkle-durkling is where you lay in bed for a little while after you wake up and get a lot of work done there. Oh, so that's what I'll do.
Have picked that from a multiple choice of
right, what? Yeah. Herkle-durkle sounds like a circus. Yes. But I'll answer emails and text messages and do anything that I can, like just while like I'm kind of waking up, which is probably the worst thing you're not supposed to pick up your phone right when you wake up, but it's whatever. It's like what I wake up thinking about is, you know, service. So it's what I wake up and do right away is usually that, and I drink like a huge glass of water, get prehydrated.
Great. You've mentioned a couple of these already, but favorite quote or mantra?
Not about me.
Good one. Last one. What's the best decision or choice you've made as an entrepreneur, either in a considered way or intuitively?
To accept that I'm never going to feel like I'm ready. And to live inside of constantly pivoting. Just yesterday, day before yesterday, the NCAA sent me a cease and desist letter for in my logo for the Changing the Game conference. I wrote on there 2024 Final Four because that's where we're having it. But apparently they have the words Final Four trademarked. I can't use them at all. And so now I had to change 14 days before the conference. I have to change all of my logos, all of my branding, my prints, my t-shirts, like everything. And it's happening. In 14 days. And so I think maybe a younger version of me, or you know, a lot of other business owners might have gotten that letter and freaked out and flipped the table and all that. I was in my bathroom, I read the email and I was like, okay. I like forwarded on to my team and they all jumped into action. They're freaking wonderful. I have such great people around me. And I was like, this is what happened. We should probably change all the branding. And they were like, okay, like pop, 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 pop. Website was fixed. Branding was fixed. We hadn't sent things into print yet. Some of the things that are already printed, it was cease and desist, not cease and go backwards. So, I mean, it just is what it is. So, the best decision I made in my business, it was to constantly be ready to pivot and like just live there all the time.
So good. Brianna Garza, thank you so much for being on the show.
Man, this is so wonderful. Thank you.
You can find show notes for this episode of The Next Step at katherinecollette.com. You can get in touch via that website or via Instagram at katherinecolletteWriter.